And our sermon text today is Ecclesiastes 11, verses 1 through 10. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to seven or even eight, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth, and if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the way the spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, and at evening withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. The Roman philosopher Cicero wrote of two friends in the Greek city of Syracuse in the 4th century BC, Damon and Pythias. The ruler of Syracuse at that time was a tyrant named Dionysius. He was a brooding, paranoid narcissist at heart. And Damon and Pythias were devotees of the philosopher Pythagoras, who championed the rights of the common people. Pythias in particular had the gift of gab, and he was preaching in the markets and the schools the principles of Pythagoras, agitating the people and aggravating the tyrant Dionysius. Dionysius saw a direct threat to his throne if Pythias continued to teach the way he was doing. So he ordered Damon and Pythias to appear before him, where he told them, "This kind of talk is treason. You are conspiring to overthrow me. Retract what you've said or face the consequences." When Pythias refused, Dionysius shouted, "Then you will die. Do you have any last requests?" Pythias asked that he might be allowed to go back to his home and say goodbye to his family and put his affairs in order. And Dionysius replied, "I see you think that I'm not only unjust, but stupid. If I let you leave Syracuse, I will never see you again." At that point, Damon stepped forward and boldly said, "I will be Pythias's pledge. Keep me in Syracuse until his return. If he does not come back, I will die in his place." Well, curious and amazed at this turn of events, Dionysius agreed to this arrangement, but he was cynically skeptical of it. And after Pythias had left and time wore on, the king scoffingly told Damon, "It is no use to beg for mercy. You were a fool to rely on your friend's promise. Did you really think he would sacrifice his life for yours or anyone else's?" Well, the day of execution came, and Dionysius told Damon, "What do you think of your friend now? He has not appeared." And Damon simply replied, "He is my friend. I trust him." And suddenly the doors flew open, and in rushed Pythias. He had been through a shipwreck, and bandits had attacked him. Various things along the way had delayed him, but he did not give up his journey. "I am ready to receive my sentence of death," he told Dionysius. But something had changed inside of King Dionysius. He says, "The sentence is revoked. I never believed that such faith and loyalty and trust could exist. You will be rewarded with your freedom, but I ask one thing. Teach me how to be part of so worthy a friendship. This is a great story from Cicero of human friendship and trust. But there's a greater level of trust which can be achieved with one greater than any mere human. It is with this one in our text today, he who lives and reigns above the sun, that we may live and trust in the daily interactions of life under the sun. This Koheleth presents to us today, and he does it through a brace of parables that prompt us to trust him. Let's look to our text today and see them unfold for us. First of all, 3 points I want to make with you from the text, 3 discrete braces of parables. First of all, verses 1-4, trust. God is providentially at work above the sun, working his will below the sun. So, know you will be blessed in your diligent, generous labors. Verses 1-4. Now, Koheleth begins his essay on trust with a series of proverbs concerning the everyday natural world. Cast your bread on the waters, give a portion to 7 or even 8. You don't know what disaster may befall you. And a chiasm concerning rain and wind in verses 3-4. Well, first of all, in your daily intercourse with the world, give freely of your earthly possessions to those in need. In your daily intercourse with the world, that's the upshot of these 2 verses. Give freely of your earthly possessions to those in need. That's the clear sense of verses 1-2. Casting and giving are both Hebrew references to blessing those less fortunate than oneself. Joseph does this in Egypt by storing up grain for the evil days for he and his people. And Job does this by incessantly casting his bread upon the waters. He says, I delivered the poor who cried for help, the fatherless who had none to help them. Additionally, David and Solomon and all the prophets, for that matter, gave, ministered, and benefited those less fortunate than they. Even our Lord told the parable of the steward who, though cynically motivated, nevertheless, as Jesus said, made friends for himself by means of wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes, from Luke chapter 16. So, give liberally. 7, even 8 portions. This is a Hebrew technique, numerical intensification, it's called. It is a graphic illustration of liberality. Give 7, even 8 portions. Proverbs also uses this technique of numerical intensification. 3 things are too wonderful for me, right? 4 I do not understand. So the upshot is to give liberally, give freely. And then secondly, closely related to this is plan wisely for the unforeseen. Some interpreters see these 2 verses as exhorting the wise business person to spread his risk, if you will. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Cast your bread upon the waters, then indicates sending investments abroad. That's how the Dutch became wealthy and built an empire. While at the same time, giving a portion to 7, even 8 refers to maybe buying some land or a lemonade stand, right? Don't use all your resources to say buy stock in FTX cryptocurrency exchange, right? Where Samuel Fried was convicted of wire fraud, commodities fraud, securities fraud, a fraudster, major business fraudster, right? Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Well, which is it? Is it generosity or wisely investing he's talking about here. Interpreters have gone back and forth. I prefer Dr. Fredrickson, who says, and I quote, "The generality of these proverbs allows for a business and a compassion application," unquote. And this is especially true if Solomon is being deliberately ambiguous for the sake of his sons. We have already said that Ecclesiastes is a wisdom tract meant to provoke the thinking of those who would follow him, that is, his sons. And also, of course, we benefit from it as well, but originally composed to be a challenge in wisdom application and thinking for his sons that would come after him on the throne. "Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deeds," as Proverbs 19:17 says. Additionally, when disaster strikes, when the unforeseen circumstance crashes in on you, both of these kinds of investments, quote unquote, will pay off. Diversity and compassion. I remember being told by my mother of my grandfather, Jules Westrow, in the late 20s. He was an up-and-coming contractor in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And then came Black Thursday, the stock market crash of 1929. And, of course, just about everyone stopped building, too, including my grandfather. He was devastated. He had six children to support, including my baby mama. But on the way up, he had practiced deeply ingrained Dutch Reform values, that is, generosity to various and sundry around him, including the poor. He began to find baskets and boxes left anonymously at his door now. Additionally, and more importantly, when locals did need something built, upon whom did they call? Jules Westrow and Sons. The bread cast upon the waters came back to him. Circumstances beyond our control, that is, acts of God, are also illustrated in an elegant chiasm in verses 3 and 4. I want you to look at these verses. A chiasm is our phrases and sentences plotted out on a key. That is, it looks like an X to us, but it's the key. Those of you in our Greek class know immediately what a key is, right? And on the various points of the key, you see verses related to each other plotted. Verse 3, for example, "If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth." Well, that is related to the last phrase in verse 4, "He who observes the wind will not sow, he who regards the clouds will not reap." You see how those two are related to each other? And then in verse 3, you have as well, and the second part of verse 3, "If a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie." And then at the beginning of verse 4, "He who observes the wind will not sow," that is, the wind that blows down the tree, right? These two are related. So, a chiasm. Here are captured the whims and fancies of nature in this chiasm. Who knows what act of God, if you will happen next, whether it be a fire or a storm or a hurricane or freezing weather, right? Who knows what act of God will happen next? We know this pretty well in Idaho, don't we? The temperature is going to be 17 degrees tomorrow in Washington, D.C., and it's so frigid that they're going to have to move the inauguration inside. And Debbie and I were talking in our sub-zero weather, minus 10 degrees. What wimps. But these kinds of things befall us. We know acts of nature here in Idaho. And the farmers in the fields around us, too, in our valley, they know the rain and the wind. Their very livelihoods depend upon God's providential distribution of both. They must trust. Note first the actions of nature how they're described. Rain falls regardless of what man can do. Wind knocks down trees regardless of what man can do, right? Here, the unseen providential hand of God is clearly offered to us. The providential hand of God, without baldly stating it. It's stated through parable, is it not? And man's folly is a response to these things. The fool, overcautious about the wind blowing away his seed, will never get it into the ground, consequently never reaping a harvest. And the fool, equally, when and if harvest is on the horizon, will never get his crops into the barn if he's overstressed about the rain ruining his crops. Farming, always a good example of God's providence, is it not? Will Rogers said, the farmer has to be an optimist or he wouldn't still be a farmer. One man said, farming is a profession of hope, isn't it? Yeah. But George Washington also said many things he said that have come down to us in history. But he said, I would rather be a farmer than an emperor of the world. Well, man's folly is a response to these things. But Koheleth here is not counseling sowing in the teeth of the wind. No, he is rather counseling against overcaution, against a failure to trust in the secret providence of God in these things, in the circumstances that one cannot control. One must risk losing if he will succeed. Wayne Gretzky said, you'll miss 100% of the shots you never take. Don't be afraid to trust God and risk. One author said, never be afraid to try something new. Remember, amateurs built the Ark, professionals built the Titanic. I love that one. You'll remember that one, won't you? Never be afraid to try something new. Amateurs built the Ark, professionals built the Titanic. And there's a Chinese proverb that says, one cannot refuse to eat because there's a risk of choking. Huh? Well, in general, great risk brings great reward, and no risk brings no reward. So, you must trust the invisible providence of an unseen God. Trust the providence of God in all of your daily interactions. Such a valuable piece of advice for us, isn't it? Well, secondly, point two, from verses 5-6, trust. God is providentially at work above the sun, working his will below the sun. So, know that his secret counsel will ineluctably come about. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, Moses told Israel. But those things that have been revealed to us belong to us and our children. His secret counsel will ineluctably come about. The biological sciences have come a long way in telling us precisely how babies are conceived and gestate and come to birth in a woman's womb. It's fascinating and it's profound, isn't it? I never, ever get over the mystery and the profundity of this, how God has indeed made us co-creators in his universe. But for most of us, the mystery is profound and unseen, as profound and unseen as our text describes it. As you do not know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child. Isn't that beautiful? That's a great translation, too, by the way, and in the ESV. Well, there should be no doubt when life begins. And it's not meant to create an argument for first, second, or third trimester abortions, but rather is an assumption by Koheleth that from the very moment of conception, God is laboring unseen, secretly knitting together that child. It's not a fetus. It's a child in the womb of the mother. Moms know this. They have that profound and mysterious gift and joy to be able to experience this, right? Feeling early on the wee one kicking and punching, doing somersaults in her belly. What a joy that is, and for Dad to be able to feel that going on in her womb as well. What a joy, what a mystery. Koheleth is drawing an analogy here. As mysterious and profound and unseen as this act of creation is in the belly of a human mother, so it is in the creation at large. Mysterious and profound and unseen. I've enjoyed several series on the History Channel. The Universe, for example. And that one deals with the forces that create and shape the universe. The heavier elements on our planet were forged in a supernovae, for example. And its companion series, How the Earth Was Made. That is how the forces of geology shaped our planet. Even with all of the knowledge and progress we have made in the sciences, there is now and always will be, especially for us Christians, that which is just out of reach. That particle that escapes detection of the most precise electron microscopes, the Higgs boson particle, for example, they call the God particle, or whatever. The terms scientists use for the matter that caused singularity or the Big Bang, the source prior to all sources in their minds. But atheistic science, as long as it continues to posit a godless universe and creation, they will live like a dog chasing his tail, spinning and spinning, churning and churning, always in pursuit of something they perceive as another thing, but which is in reality the shadow and hindmost of themselves. But this is more than an academic question. Verse 6 goes on to apply this principle to everyday life. Precisely because a providential hand is at work behind the scenes, laboring to determine the destiny of all things. You, dear laborer, work all day to make fruitful your trust, your estate, trusting that the God who loves you will prosper it. Indeed, Ecclesiastes is not a counsel of despair. All is not vain and meaningless, right, as so many translations have for us. No, it may be brief, it may be vaporous, but it is still good. And we are meant to work, to labor, to bring to our next generation our estate, that which we have fructified, made fruitful. And there's a double entendre here. In the time signature, time is the dimension that most preoccupies Koheleth, by the way. Things may be vaporous and brief. Sow your seed in the morning, he says. That is, early in the day, or early in life. Double entendre here. Sow your seed early and in life as well as in the morning. And then also in the evening withhold not your hand. That is at the end of day and at the sunset of life too. Both withhold not your hand from your labors. Both in the short run, that is during your workday, and in the long run, in the overall course of your life, be diligent to sow seed. That is, start businesses, a family, a church, a network of friends and business associates. As these kinds of things are inculcated in culture, you have produced what we have produced in the West over centuries, right? A fruitful, constructive civilization and culture. This is what we are destined to do. It is fulfilling the Great Commission to indeed multiply and prosper, right? Be diligent to sow seed. Start businesses, a family, a church, a network of friends and business associates, and don't stop. This is an encouragement towards godly ambition. Godly ambition. Christians should be the most hardworking, ambitious people on earth. Bring all of these things to fruition. Harvest them later in life as well as later in a single workday. But know as well, keep in mind that all of these things are at risk too. Job is a testament to that, isn't it? Your business, your family, your church, that network of friends and business associates, they may all or severally die or go bust or fail. That is the risk. But the point is, one or more or all may prosper and succeed. You do not know. You do not know. But you must not stop from trying. You must trust. You must trust. This is important pastoral advice to you here today. Some of you may see no fruit in sowing the seed of family, for example, or harvesting the fruit of family begun and sown, but don't give up. Others see no fruit in your careers or your chosen field, perhaps. Do not give up. Who knows but that God will prosper you in the future. We've seen that replicated time and time again. How many people have started businesses that have failed, and then finally one that springs to life, right? Some of you may see no fruit in your spiritual lives or that of your family or network of friends and business associates. Do not give up. Who knows but that God will not prosper your future. My father, for example, is the fruit of my mother's labors for 40 years. No, I thought, even my father's heart is too hard to reach. But my mother finally reached him late in her life. And I was the fruit of my mother and grandmother's prayers for 10 years as well. You do not know. Do not give up. In fact, all of it may be good in the end. All of you must admit that some of it is good, right? God has been faithful in all of these things. So, the upshot is risk, trust, and receive as a good gift those things providentially brought to you in your thorough labors. They may be vaporous and only last for a while, but they do point heavenwards. Your labors under the sun point toward the good God above the sun who is providentially working in your life. That brings us to point three, verses 7 through 10. Trust. God is providentially at work above the sun, working his will below the sun. So no, your fleeting, fun-filled life will be brought to account. Your life will be brought to account. Verse 7 is a sweet transition from points 2 and 3. Light is sweet. That's a word always used with honey. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. Moving from the morning in verse 6 to the evening and darkness of old age in verse 8, Koheleth acknowledges that there is an impending close to it all. Life is vaporous and brief after all. The older I get, the more I enjoy the simple things, as does Koheleth apparently. I love bread and wine and warm sunlight on my face. And we have plenty of that in our valley. What a great place to be. We have so many cures for bad eyesight, for example. Cataracts can be removed, vision can be corrected so that we can see the sunlight. Perhaps Solomon's eyesight began to fail, even as his father David's eyesight failed him in his later years. So Solomon concludes that is because light is sweet, that is, life is good. That's a euphemism for life is good, is it not? If a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. That is, don't sink into despair and vanity and meaninglessness. Take it at face value. But there is a caveat born of wisdom. He says and insists, the grave is dark for a long time. Just go knock on my father's casket and ask him, hey, is it dark in there? For how long will it be dark, huh? while not eternal, the place that goes on and on is the grave for a very long time. We as Christians indeed have hope that that will not be the case through eternity, and we have that assurance, do we not? Through Christ's resurrection. But the grave is still dark for a long time. And secondly, life is illumined for a brief time. That's a sense of all that comes is vaporous, not vanity, right? It's not vain, but it is vaporous. All that comes is vaporous. Solomon is reprising his theme from chapter 6. Once again, he returns to these motifs, does he not? And expands upon them every time he comes back to them. And back in verse 6, verses 3 through 5, if a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness. Now let's substitute that word vaporous, right? And see how much better sense it makes. For it comes in vapor and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. The grave is dark for a long time. But so is grief and sorrow, brief and temporary, right? He's also insisted on this. Sorrow is also brief and temporary. Back in chapter 2, verses 18 to 26, he says, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity, or is it vaporous? This also is vaporous. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This is also vaporous and a great evil, or vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity, or vaporous. There's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. That's his bottom line. Not meaningless, but vaporous. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vaporous and a striving after wind. Wow. Solomon continues then his balanced approach. Grief and sorrow are brief and temporary, so is life and light and joy. But he continues by exclaiming, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. This is true, sincere advice with no catches. He's not being ironic here. So, boys, go out and seize the day. Be ambitious with a godly ambition. You are God's vice regents in creation. You are meant to labor and work and build an estate, a family, a community, an inheritance for future generations. So do it with gusto and energy. That's the sense of walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But pastor, you may say, I thought the heart was desperately wicked beyond cure. The eyes were put upon the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and it's desirable for food. Isn't it better to flee to a monastery, eat stale bread and brackish water, never to look upon a woman, and live in poverty the rest of my life in order to resist temptation? That's just my brief summary. I've got a 5-minute, a 15-minute, and a 1-hour sermon on this. That's the Roman Catholic solution, isn't it? The two-tiered spirituality. the ascetic answer, right? I love meditation. Let others propagate, right? But it's not the biblical solution. It's not the gospel answer. Luther answered the Roman Catholic Church by marrying Katie, my rib, right? You read Luther's biography, just a sweet biography. Katie, my rib, he calls her. He affectionately called her, and he said about her, he said, in domestic affairs, I am led by Katie. Otherwise, I'm led by the Holy Spirit. The Reformers' counsel was also, rather than flee to a monastery, was to go out and follow Kohelis' advice here. Enthusiastically marry. Enthusiastically work, however humble your woka, too. That's a gift of the West, a gift of the Bible as well. The idea, Calvin called it your woka. That is what you are called to do. It may be as a humble farmer or janitor, but you do that labor as unto the Lord, and it has its own inherent dignity and calling. Luther wanted the humble plowman to have the scriptures in German. Calvin went out, not many people know this, but in his biography, he went out and personally enlisted godly tradesmen and laborers for office. He went out to the small hamlets of Switzerland and recruited deacons and elders for the churches there. So, take it from the Reformers, and from the Scriptures, and from Solomon here, from Kohelis. Build an estate. Build a community. Build a church. Create a heritage for your family, however brief and transitory and subject to destruction it may be. And this is emphasized in verse 10. Put away vexation from your heart, and put away pain from your body. That is, make provision as best you can do, knowing it is not always possible to do it completely, perhaps. For youth and the dawn of life are vanity, he says. Now, that just doesn't make any sense, that it's vain and meaningless after having just encouraged us to do it. So vaporous or brief is better. For youth and the dawn of life are vaporous, are they not? That makes so much more sense. But there's a gospel caveat here, too. Know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Don't do them helter-skelter. Don't do them with an evil heart. Do them with a righteous heart. You knew there was a catch, right? But it's not a catch. It's a caveat. Solomon always and ever balances and qualifies this enthusiasm with the sobering reality that we are fallen creatures as we go about these things. And we must temper all of our actions with a divine leading. Perhaps in things domestic, Luther is led by Katie, but in all other things, Luther and you must be led by the Holy Spirit. Do you see how increasingly now, as we have moved through Ecclesiastes, the pace of our vision above the sun has increased. Explicit references have increased. Explicit references to the Lord are gradually becoming louder and louder. The realm above the sun is increasingly invading the realm under the sun, precisely as it does in the course of redemptive history. It's doing so here in the book of Ecclesiastes. Gradually, almost imperceptibly, Solomon has woven together his wisdom tract to bring the two increasingly as one. That's going to increase as we conclude in chapter 12. In the rolling recurrence of returning motifs, this one is coming around again, fleshed out, filled out with increasing detail. There is indeed a gospel day coming, when God will bring all things to account. We know this well, do we not, from the scriptures? For us, as well as our co-laborers in Solomon's day, this will be a day of rejoicing and vindication. Solomon was preparing his generation and hopefully his sons, for that day, as diligently as the apostles are preparing us. James puts it this way. He says, be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or under any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. You will be called to account. So take heed. You've been warned. You've been exhorted. You've been encouraged. Trust in Christ first and foremost. Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved, you and your household. Trust him not only for bare salvation, but for the very things we've seen and been describing here this day. And may you see the purpose of the Lord and find him compassionate and merciful, not only today, but on the great day. Trust him as you would an unfailing friend, even more than Damon trusted Pythias. Jesus is, after all, a friend too, a friend of sinners, is he not? Let us now come to that place then where we find the goodness of the Lord promised to us in the body and blood of the Lord, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.